This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
This week we're speaking about various beasties, some of them proving more controversial than others.
Yesterday morning I actually thought that I'd slept in. You know, I got up, probably at 5:45 in the morning, something like that, and I thought, I didn't realise it was 5:45, but I thought, oh no, you know, it's light, it's daylight. It wasn't at all. The moon was so bright, it was unbelievably bright. I mean, more or less you could have read a newspaper by moonlight yesterday. Slightly overcast this morning, but not bad. We're not complaining. Good morning. I'm Mark Stephen. Right beside me, the other side of the fire, Rachel Stewart.
Yeah, it's been a spectacular moon the last few days. Yeah. At the moment, I'm just trying to dodge sparks from the fire. The fire is particularly impressive today.
Sparky.
Yeah, it is a wee bit sparky, though, but it is giving us some much-needed heat. Although, I have to say, it's been a fabulous few days.
Yeah.
And I usually go out for a walk every evening, and it's become really quite busy. So other people are thinking, yeah, I need to get outside as well, enjoy the slightly milder weather.
The Inverurie Passagiata.
Let us know what you're up to today. We'd love to know your plans. Are you getting outdoors? Email us, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295 or give us a ring, 08085 92950.
This week, I've been at the Highland Wildlife Park finding out about wildcats. And while I was in the area, I also heard about recent disquiet amongst farmers and crofters in the Cairngorms National Park, and we've got more of that coming up.
Yeah, we'll hear from a farmer and also from Grant Moyer from the National Park, so of course stay tuned for that. Plus honey, woodworking and a smattering of barns thrown in for good measure. I'm hoping you're going to give us a few rousing renditions.
I'll tell you, I'll be all over the car park. Need to tie me down.
First, as always, we've got a mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
We think that's a cracking mystery sound.
We do. It's a great one for January.
This is a doable one. You might actually get this.
It doesn't sound completely dissimilar to ones that we've had in previous weeks, actually. But it is a different thing.
Yeah, and it's not mechanical.
It's not mechanical. You say that every week.
Every week.
So out of doors at bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or you can call us 08085 92950. Now, we've all heard of wine tasting. Are you a fan?
Of wine tasting?
Yeah.
No, you have to spit it out.
You've just spit it out and you know it's coming.
No, I'm not doing that, no.
What about honey tasting? Have you done that?
No, never have.
Okay, well, Dr. Gino Jabbar, who is the owner of Simply Honey, is a trained sommelier and he runs courses for those interested in finding out a bit more about this. He argues that honey is a taste of the landscape. Well, I met up with him close to a community beehive in Edinburgh and was treated to a bit of a tasting session.
So what we're going to do is we're going to take a sample of honey out of the jar and we're going to carefully place it inside our effectively small wine glasses.
We are in Edinburgh, so you can expect this whole thing to be quite posh. You've got crystal glasses here.
Only the best. And because there are volatile aroma compounds in honey and they're of different solubilities in water and also different sizes, so these compounds, similar to compounds in perfume, because honey is very dry, so honey's usually less than 18% water, those aroma molecules are stuck in the honey, in the crystal structure. And what we're doing is using a spoon is we're just opening the honey up, pushing it against the sides of the glass and then holding the underside of the glass with our hand to warm it with our body heat. And what this does is it starts to evaporate off those wonderful aroma compounds for us to experience on the nose.
So you've just scraped a little bit of honey from one of your jars into the crystal glass. You're giving it a nice stir around the glass just now and holding it to heat it up a little.
Absolutely. Then what we do is we inhale, we smell the honey, and this gives us information on sometimes of major nectars, but also it can inform us of the taste as well.
Now, some of these honeys are from the same location, but from a different time during the year, is that right?
That's correct. So what one of the factors that affects the flavours and aromas of honey is the time of year, as well as the location. At different times of the year, different flowers are in bloom, and so you're getting different nectars coming into the hive, and so these are harvested at different times of the year to produce different varieties. Or you can have bees in a different location where there's different flora in the landscape, and so you'll get different flavours.
And it makes a real difference to the taste, does it? Or is it quite subtle?
It's really different, because honey is the taste of the landscape. Honey as a food is a food which has the greatest variety of flavours and aromas of any food type, because the flavour in honey derives from the flowers the bees are visiting, and also non-flower sources like honeydew from different insects like aphids. And if you think of the completely amazing number of flowers that exist on Earth, you get honeys that are sour, that are bitter, umami. You've got then all different types of aromas as well. So where we're used to wonderful food groups such as wine, and there has such a variety in wine, in the end of the day, wine is still confined to the wonderful types of grapes. But with honey, you have so many, almost countless numbers of potential plants that can contribute to the flavour.
And is there a honey for everyone, Gino?
Yes.
Because I would say, and confession time here, that if I was having toast, I probably wouldn't naturally put honey on it. I'm sorry to admit this, but it's true. Because I don't really like things that are incredibly sweet. But would you say that there is an option out there for me?
Yes, absolutely. And there is definitely a honey for everyone. I mean, some varieties are not very sweet. Some are bitter, as I've mentioned. Some are sour. And so you'll find a flavour for you. So this honey is rapeseed honey from East Lothian, and it has a quite strong vegetal taste to it and smell. The smell is quite distinctive for rapeseed. It's a slight smell of cabbage, because the family Brassicanapis is related to cabbages, and so. But the actual taste is slightly different. It's a really sweet, buttery, textured honey. And it's delightfully confectionery sweet.
Okay. So shall I have a little smell? I can actually smell exactly what you're saying. It does smell a bit like the rapeseed.
Yes. And do you want to try some?
Yes, please.
Intensely sweet.
Very, very sweet. Very, very sweet. Very, very smooth.
Smooth and buttery on the palate.
It tastes quite indulgent.
It is, it is. And this honey is very popular and honey in Scotland. We have and we grow so much rapeseed for its oil. And the presence of bees on the fields of rapeseed also boosts the harvest. Because although rapeseed is a wind-pollinated crop, having bees actually improves the harvest for the farmer as well. So we're also helping out our friends in farming.
Yeah, that's really delicious. You can imagine how lovely that would be on some toast.
So we always suggest that one of the best ways to experience rapeseed honey is to put it on toast. And that's because it's normally presented in what's called soft set form. And that's,
which means it's not a nightmare to get out of the jar.
Yes. So this honey it crystallises quite rapidly when it's first brought out of a beehive. And it's because it's very high in glucose relative to fructose sugar. And so what beekeepers do is they prepare it in a form called soft set. That texture is wonderful because, like a good ice cream, you can't actually taste the crystals. The crystals are smaller than your tongue can perceive.
Yeah,
and that gives
smooth.
That beautifully buttery-like texture.
And you can hear more from Dr. Gino Jabbar by listening to our Scotland's Outdoors podcast, available on BBC Sounds. I learned a lot from that, actually.
Yeah, I think he's a really interesting guy, obviously knows loads about it. He said to me that last year was a particularly good year in spring for hawthorn. And that really came across in the honey, so that it produced a sort of smoky, almost whiskey taste to the honey, which he thought was really, really nice. And good if, like me, you don't like a particularly sweet sensation.
Yeah, obviously, it's entirely logical. If you're going to do a bit of piece about honey, send you who doesn't like honey.
Well, I don't dislike it. It's just not my number one choice. But actually, having spent a bit of time with Gino, I think there is a honey out there that I quite like. And certainly abroad, you could find honeys that are much less sweet than you'll find here.
He makes a point in the podcast, which you'll hear if you go to BBC Sounds, where he basically says most of the honey that's sold is junk.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say that, not in those terms. He says, but he insists it's poorer quality, it's adulterated, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. He says, but the real, because I've always looked at things like, you know, there's that Manuka honey. Mm-hmm. You go, yeah, what?
Yeah, very
expensive.
That's
like a mortgage.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and in some countries abroad, you know, they are willing to spend a lot of money on their honey, much more than they would spend on the other delicacies that we might think about, like alcohol or whatever. They'll invest in honey.
Yeah.
It's quite nice. Are you a fan?
I do like honey, but I mean, you know, the other point he makes is if you are a beekeeper, you must harvest your honey regularly in terms of the emergence and consumption and basically production of the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so as that flower comes up and it goes again, what have you, it disappears, comes and goes, you know, and it's different ones throughout the year, and the honey changes.
Yeah. And I think if you're really sampling it in the way that I was, you really can detect those subtle differences in taste.
Nice. I bet you I couldn't.
Well, it depends what you put it on or put it in.
I have a wooden mouth.
At one point I did say to him, could you bake with this? And he did look rather aghast.
Oh, again, he talked about baking honey. I had no idea of the existence of it.
Yeah. So that's probably just not quite such good stuff.
Aye.
You know, perfectly watery honey. More water in it. Now, around this time last year, I visited the Highland Wildlife Park in Kinghussie to hear about a forthcoming project to release a number of wildcat kittens born under their conservation programme into the Cairngorm National Park.
Now, the release of the young cats took place in summer last year, and I caught up with Helen Sen, who's Head of Conservation and Science at RZSS, to find out what's been happening. We started off looking at the wild cats that are never going to be released.
Right, so we're walking into Wildcat Wood at the moment, and this is the area within the Highland Wildlife Park where we have our wildcats that are on show to the public. The wildcats here are part of the conservation breeding programme for wildcats. There's approximately 150 cats spread across any one point in time around 30 to 40 different zoos and institutions in the UK. And that's the critical breeding insurance population for the whole species. And then from that population, we have cats that are breeding off show at the back of the park, in a very private, secluded area. And those are the parents of the cats that are then going out to the wild. So the kittens that are born there are the cats that are being released into the wild.
These cats have people wondering about them all the time. The ones right at the back of the park do not. How do you avoid them becoming habituated? You know, basically stop being nervous about human presence. You've got to feed them at some stage, presumably.
Yes, so the cats at the back of the park only see the expert keeper team that we have at the Saving Wild Cats project, and they only have contact with that very infrequently, and we have a really big array of CCTV cameras that we use to look into that facility in order to be able to manage the cat's welfare and monitor their behaviour, so we don't need to do much hands-on caring for them.
The old expression, curiosity killed the cat. Even wild cats must get curious. What happens if the cats that are meant to be wild, that will be released back into the wild, start becoming a little too curious about the keepers, a little too friendly?
Well, their whole life really has been lived away from human presence. But we do use our CCTV facility to kind of test how curious they are. So, for example, when our keepers are going up to feed them, we have someone else back in the centre watching live on camera to see how the cat's responding to keeper presence. We have a way of scoring that. And if it's too positive, then we do what we call aversion training, which is essentially doing a few things to kind of scare the cat a little bit so that they don't kind of create a positive association with human presence. And we also have various other things, like, for example, we only use electric vehicles to drive up into that area, so they're not hearing a lot of car engine sound and associating that with food. And really everything that we do in that centre is modelled on the Iberian Lynx reintroduction project in Spain, which is a very successful carnivore reintroduction project where they've adopted similar methods and had a really successful recovery of the species using captive bred lynx. So we've learned an awful lot from our colleagues there in Spain and Portugal.
Like the Iberian Lynx, you know, the Scottish wildcat is a hunter. How do you teach it? There's one behind us, isn't there? Oh, look at that. Look at that. Up top there, eating away at something.
Yeah, so it's currently feeding on a small chick, I think. Uh-huh.
Got a mouthful of feathers at the moment. There's another one across there. They're beautiful animals. But as I was saying, you know, they are hunters. So, you know, the ones that are going to be released into the wild, how do you train them to hunt in captivity?
Well, really, what we're doing is we're trying to provide them with as natural an environment as possible. So the cats, as we said, they're bred away from human presence, but they're also in large enclosures with a lot of habitat. And we try to do all sorts of things to vary the cat's routine in terms of where the food is delivered and the time of day it's delivered and things like that. And we're able to watch how they're behaving. We can't, in this country, we're not allowed to feed live prey. That's, you know, a law for welfare reasons. But what we do know is because we've now had cats out in the wild since June and those cats are doing really well. We know that they're eating, we know they're hunting and behaving naturally. We've seen lots of evidence of that, and obviously the fact that they're still around is evidence of that. So we know that it's working.
There are enclosures amongst these trees surrounding us here, and there are overhead tunnels, and, you know, needless to say, they've now disappeared. You know, as we've been speaking, they've just vaporised. How do you know that that's a Scottish wildcat rather than just a chunky tabby?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And we've done lots of background research on that. So we do a lot of genetic testing and that's really informed our project. So going back perhaps a decade, very little was known about wildcat genetics and they are threatened by hybridisation or interbreeding with domestic cat. And some of the genetic research that's been conducted in recent years, led by the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland and our lab down at Edinburgh Zoo, has really shown that hybridisation in the wild is very extreme. And it's also helped us to manage the hybridisation that we do have in the captive breeding programme. So there is some hybridisation, but not a lot. And we manage the breeding really carefully to minimise that, but also to make sure we have a healthy, unrelated as possible genetic population.
Helen said there, Head of Conservation and Science at the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland. A little bit more from the Can You See Wildcats later on in the programme.
Yeah, interesting. When I was there last year, they were just in pre-release enclosures, and because obviously they wanted to keep the public far away from them, it was like a speck in the distance, right. You know. But it was interesting at that point, they just didn't know how they would adapt to the wild at all. Obviously they hoped it would go well, and it obviously has.
Yes, no. Well, interesting, you know, what you refer to as the show cats, you know, the cats that the, you know, the public can wander in amongst. They have these overhead, like, tunnels, wild tunnels and what have you. And I mean, they are just like domestic cats.
Yeah.
You know,
they
just kind of lie around and look bored and slightly disdainful. You know,
give you a bit of attitude.
Yeah, that whole thing about dogs of owners and cats of staff.
Yeah, you know, I think that is true, actually.
Yeah,
it is true. But no, it'd be interesting to see, because I think there's another release, isn't there, this year, and then one next year as well.
Yeah. You're listening to Outdoors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, one of the North East's most popular walking trails.
And, of course, a mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
We've got some incorrect answers already. Ian reckons it's the sound of an electric spark jumping between two points. He says, I've tried it for hair restoration, but to no avail.
Ian V. Sterling says, good morning. This morning we'll be walking our dogs to Carluke's Nature Trail and then participating in the Big Garden Birdwatch, of course.
This weekend.
Yeah, it's this weekend. I think the mystery sounds like last week's mystery sound, possibly water hitting a top canvas.
Taut.
Yeah, I think that as well.
Yeah, and Ian V. Sterling thinks it's a Guy Fawkes night sparkler.
Okay. That's a good one. Denise and Phil, your Speyside superfans. Good morning, Mark and Rachel. It's a lovely fresh morning in Rothes. To plagiarise Alistair from just up the road in Elgin, is today's mystery sound grains of rice being poured onto a rusty tin roof? Rachel, you've started a great what do you spread on your toast debate? Denise loves honey, but I prefer golden syrup. Oh, now that is sweet.
Golden syrup, it's not only sweet, it's got a mind of its own.
Mm-hmm.
It goes everywhere except the toast, in my mind.
Do you make a big mess?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not to put too fine a point.
No surprise. I can see some traces of it on your jacket.
That's why I gave up wearing ties. You got a good bowl of soup at any of my time.
If you've any idea what today's mystery sound is, you've got loads of time to email us in. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or you can ring us 0808 529500. Now, this sounds like the kind of programme that you would watch, Britain's Best Woodworker. Mm-hmm. You see it on telly recently?
Funnily enough, it's not one of the ones I watch, but I do like quality craftsmanship.
Okay. Well, if you watch this programme, you may remember one of the stars, Jen Humphreys. The designer and maker from the northeast of Scotland was actually runner-up in the latest series of the show, and she was tasked with making all sorts of challenging projects, kitchen islands, that kind of thing. I was invited along to her workshop, which is in a particularly lovely location in a ducat at Banff Castle.
When I first arrived, it was just a blank canvas. So for this first year, things have been moving around and finally I'm happy with the setup. And like I've got a lathe, I've got my bandsaw and sander and things. But importantly, I've got my bench, which has followed me, stayed in my parents' garage for so long. So they were very grateful to get rid of it. And all my tools and things up on the wall and some finished pieces.
Well, we're going to head over to your workbench because you've got some sanding to do, haven't you?
There's always sanding to do. It's a permanent state.
So what are you making here just now?
I'm just making a little dish just now. I've turned the inside on the lathe and then I've taken off and I've been cutting away the edges. So now they need a lot of sanding.
And what kind of wood is this that you're working with?
This is a piece of sycamore, actually. So it's really nice, bright, kind of whitish colour. Which I actually love working with. It's nice, smooth to work with.
And will you need to treat this in any way after you've moulded it into the shape that you want?
That's it. I will have to do something with it. To be honest, this workshop is me just playing around right now. So, like, I've been experimenting with lots of different finishes. In school, we're constantly doing certain types of finishes.
And just for this to make sense, you are a teacher. That's what you mean about being in school, isn't it?
Yes, that's it. So I'm woodwork teacher Monday to Friday.
And master craftswoman the rest of the time.
I mean, I try. I'm learning. There's always so much to learn.
Now, recently, you have taken part in a TV show to find Britain's best woodworker. How was that? Because you were set some pretty challenging tasks.
Yeah, to make those things in 2 days was madness. I don't think I'll ever work to that timescale ever again. It was a bit crazy, but it's amazing what you can get done in 2 days when you just get your head down and go for it.
So these were beds and chairs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we were making huge things, kitchen islands and what else did we make? Benches, but they all had to be original designs. So a lot of it was a bit of a gamble to, will this work? Because you couldn't have a practice run at it.
And how did you approach that then? What sort of mental approach did you take to it?
I had the ideas. I was like all over that in my head. I was like, this will be great. Let's try this. But I had to be practical. And I think probably as a teacher, we're quite good at making things to a time scale. Because you're thinking, when's the school bell going to be? So you have to plan everything out. Like, when are you going to glue up? When are you going to trim this down? Will this be dry in time, etc.?
And you must have been pretty proud of what you achieved.
Oh, I went down there not expecting anything. I was like, I literally packed a bag for like a week. I was like, this will be fine, I'll then come back. I was running out of shampoo, I was running out of toothpaste, it was getting stressful.
Because you were there right to the end of the competition.
I wouldn't have gone down calling myself a woodworker, to be honest, since I'd never made anything that big. We'd made little small school projects, and so I was very excited. Anytime I finished something, I was so relieved.
So just explain what you're doing here and what you're trying to create.
So I guess here I've turned the inside of this piece of sycamore, and what we're doing now is I've carved the outside to get that organic shape inspired by the local rocks. And they are rough edges, so there's a lot of sanding that needs done now.
And you do it all manually?
The reality is that, like, a lot of what I do is manual because that's what I'm more comfortable with. I think with the show, the TV show with the big builds, I was having to use a lot more power tools than I am used to, and that was a bit scary, especially doing it on camera for the first time, for example. So I actually am getting more confident with using power tools and things, but I enjoy doing it by hand more. I think that's more important to me, but there are certain things that is more efficient.
Yeah, do you just feel a bit closer to the process if you're doing it manually?
Yeah, if I'm doing it manually, I can control it more, I feel, and you can pause very quickly and just think, is that working? Does that look good? And edit it if it needs editing.
So tell me how you got into this then.
I originally did graphic design at university and art school in Aberdeen, and when I left that, I thought, I don't want to sit at a computer anymore. I enjoyed that, and I learned so much about the aesthetic of things, and that visual kind of communication, I guess. And then I went and actually did furniture restoration, specifically like traditional upholstery pieces, and really enjoyed that, but was like, how do I get a job doing this that's going to give me a steady income, you know? And actually got a job doing the design side of that for a company in London, and really enjoyed it. But the reality was that I wanted to be back in Scotland, and we struggled to get apprentices with the willingness to learn and things in that job. So I was like, well, maybe I could be a teacher and go and try and inspire them.
And do you come from a family who are really interested in this kind of thing?
Oh God, absolutely not. My parents they were doctors, they've since retired, and my brother works for a software company and things, so this has gone rogue.
So this is all quite alien to them as well.
Yeah, I think my mum hadn't seen me like use a saw until she saw it on TV, so I think that she was pretty mortified by that. But they're super supportive of it.
Is it quite tricky though? I mean, it looks like there's a lot to learn and be familiar with to create, you know, some of these big pieces of furniture that you've been doing.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that there's always going to be stuff for me to learn. Like, I'm very much learning as I go with certain things, and thinking back to where I was a year ago or 2 years ago, I've learned so much more, and that's exciting. And I think that's especially in school, you're like wanting to kind of reassure the kids that you'll keep learning and learning. So that's,
and not to be intimidated by it.
Oh, for sure. Like, you don't want to be intimidated by what it is. And I think the bigger things that I have made is because I had the chance to do it. And you don't say no to something like that, do you? Like, go for it.
It's actually amazing how quick that does take shape, though, doesn't it? I know that it's involving a bit of elbow grease from you, but you can see that it is forming a lovely little bowl now.
Yeah, you do get quicker at it over time as well. I try and reassure the school kids that. They're like, this is taking forever. And you're like, no, it does get faster.
Woodworker Jen Humphreys there.
Yeah, we were just talking about what you made at school in your techie classes. Oh. Can you remember? I mean, it is going back a bit.
Stupid things like, an aluminium coat hook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think maybe thing. They still do that.
Yeah, and there was like a thing for putting hot pots on.
Okay. You know. I made a wooden pencil case, which even 30-odd years ago wasn't cool. No one was using that for their stationery, and it probably didn't help that my lid wouldn't shut either.
See, I wasn't helped by the fact my dad was a technical teacher, so when I did technical at school, I kept on really annoying the teacher by saying, but why don't we use that machine over there? It's going to be much, much quicker. You know, because I've probably been using it since about the age of six. You know.
Yeah, I can imagine that might be quite aggravating.
Yeah, no. I think I probably annoyed plenty of teachers in my time. Yeah.
I would like to think that they make things that are a bit more groovy nowadays.
Doubt it. I really, really doubt it. Coming up, the best lead schemes are Mason Maingang Afterglow. Let's face it, we had to get some burns in this week. And the battle to save East Weems Caves from the sea, which, you know, they got help from a really unlikely source.
Yeah, of course, we've also got a mystery sound. Let's have a listen.
Okay. See, I think that's a really, really distinctive sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hear that every year.
Okay, that's a good clue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They have a nice email in from Ron from Stirling. Following the good advice from a fellow listener on Out of Doors a few weeks ago, my wife put some twigs from our dormant-looking forsythia into a jug of water.
Mm-hmm.
Hey presto, 3 weeks later, we have a splendid display of yellow flowers just as promised. So bringing Out of Doors indoors worked a treat.
We have forsythia, which I think is also known as winter jasmine, but we've also got a big shrub in the corner which produces pink flowers, and they are night-scented.
All right.
For the life of me, I cannot remember what that thing's called.
Mm-hmm.
If you know...
Get in touch. Yeah. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295, or you can email, you can ring in 08085 92 95 00.
Now, you may have seen press coverage over the past few weeks of a group going under the banner of the Cairngorms Crofters and Farmers Group. Now, they've held a couple of gatherings, basically to voice their grievances over the recent release. Well, one of the things they're worried about is the recent release of beavers into the national park. I met one of the organisers, Rory Ormiston, and asked him, what's your main issue here?
The problem is that the beavers are coming, or well, the beavers are already here, and we weren't really informed about it, and a lot of us missed the consultation events because we hadn't really taken them seriously, I suppose.
Well, is that not your fault then? If there were consultation events and you didn't attend them?
Well, the main consultation event for us that was kind of published was the Grantine Show, but by the time the Grantine Show came round, the beavers were already coming. It was only to inform us that the beavers were coming.
And what's your concern about the beavers being in the area?
The damage that they'll do. I've been down to Tayside and I visited a friend's farm, and I've been to see other places that beavers have been. And, you know, the damage is considerable. We know that from all the flood banks and everything that we have in the area, that there will be potential for damage. The Shinty Field down the road there, if they burrow into the riverbank there, they could erode the shinty pitch away.
And I've spoken to people from the National Park Authority in the past, and they said, well, actually, there's not that much arable land within the boundaries of the National Park, near rivers and things like that. Is that your perception?
Yeah, you have to remember, these people are quite new to the area, 5 or 10 years, so they imagine it's not arable land, and maybe it's not classified as arable land, but it's what fed the Highlanders for years. And the four-acre field across the railway there...
The one that's currently underwater.
The one that's currently underwater, but the beavers are going to stop all that flooding, apparently. The field there, during the Second World War, that's what fed the sanatorium up the road. That's what grew all the vegetables for the sanatorium, and they had 2 or 3 full-time gardeners working on it. So we can grow food when we have to. It's just with current systems, most of us are livestock farmers, so we grow grass and feed it to animals.
When the balloon went up in this area and there was an immediate concern among some farmers and crofters, what kind of reaction did you get in the initial meetings?
We couldn't believe the turnout. We were expecting 20 to 25 people at the initial meeting. I think we'd over 47 and about 17 apologies. We were just astounded. It kind of highlighted the fact that it wasn't just the beavers. People were genuinely concerned that we weren't being consulted on other issues like... you know, the moorland issues, reducing stocking densities, the wildcats and all that kind of stuff. We just weren't being consulted properly. They have an agricultural officer, and there's not that many farmers and crofters in the park, and if they had a list, and I'm sure they don't have a list, but if they had a list, it would be easy enough for the agricultural officer to phone round or email or even go round knocking doors and consult properly, but they haven't done that.
What do you want to do as a group? What is it you want to achieve?
Well, I'm sure the National Park Authority think we're just a lynch mob, but we're not. We're a lot more than that. We've formed ourselves, we've called ourselves Cairngorm Crofters and Farmers because it's now grown bigger than just the River Spey. And we hope to do a lot of positive things as well. You know, education of the communities of what we do, marketing of local produce, you know, activities on farms for local families to come and do stuff. But we need to get over this hurdle first.
The hurdle being the fact that you're struggling to communicate with the National Park Authority, or they don't want to communicate with you, or that's your perception?
I think it's more than a perception. They've been awarded about £500,000 worth of funding through the Heritage Horizons. It's a small percentage of the Heritage Horizon Award, but it's for farming, and it's to fund the future farming scheme, of which 6 farms are involved. And none of us knew about the future farming scheme. We don't know who the 6 farms are, how they were selected. And if they're bringing that kind of funding into the park, they should be asking us what we want it spent on, or what do we want help on.
You'll know the old expression, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the oil. How much noise are you prepared to make?
Well, we've been doing a fair bit of squeaking, granting last Monday with 20 tractors, and Ballater this Monday with probably about 20 as well, but it was a mixture of tractors and Gamekeepers Land Rovers and things. So we've done a bit of squeaking, and we might do some more squeaking. And then
it's been driving about tooting horns and protesting, essentially.
We weren't protesting, we were showing our concern.
Rory Ormiston there, part of the Cairngorms Crofters and Farmers Group. Well, joining us now is Grant Moyer, Chief Executive of the Cairngorm National Park Authority. Grant, the fact that this group has been formed, that they felt the necessity to form it, suggests there's something of a problem. Do you agree?
Well, I think it's great that the group is formed and provide a voice in the area, and you know, dialogue and two-way dialogue between people is always great. And I think really, I mean, Rory mentioned the engagement and making sure that early engagement, and you know, for instance, if you take Rory himself, he was contacted last February about the beaver reintroduction. We had a follow-up video call with Rory. We had a site visit with Rory. Rory came along to the beaver drop-in in Canusi. His quote he left with us was, it was very informative and it was great engagement. And then that was followed up with a trip where we took farmers up to see the beavers at South Clunes as well. We've done multiple trips like that. So there was a lot of engagement with farmers. And I think one of the things we've got to think about is, you know, when we're engaging with people, is making sure that people understand the changes that we're making. So if you look at the beavers side of things, we made lots of changes to the management and mitigation plan on the back of feedback from farmers and other stakeholders and other people to try and get the right scheme in place for beaver reintroduction into the national park.
So how come they didn't clock to the fact that it was your intention to actually reintroduce beavers? How did this come as a surprise to them?
Well, I mean, the decision by the board in June 2022 was taken in public, and that was obviously to take forward a beaver translocation licence for the national park. We ran a number of drop-ins throughout 2023. We tried to speak to as many people as possible. There was 40 site visits with farmers all across the area. And I think probably there's a difference between, I suppose this is where we got to tease out some of these things, which is, I suppose, engagement, agreement, and how we take forward these things with people. We want to work with people. We want to make sure it works well. And I think the mitigation scheme we've put in place really did take account of that. I mean, some of the stuff that Rory was talking about there around flood banks, for instance, well, we listened to what they said, and we've put in place a flood bank guarantee within the national park as well, where we're looking to support if there are any issues with beavers and flood banks, and the Park Authority will step in with grant aid to deal with that. So that I think we did listen. I think we changed things. But we can always learn. We can always engage even earlier. We can try and make sure we get to everyone. And that's certainly something that we'll be looking to do in the future. But I think it is also about, you know, both of us listening to each other in terms of how we go forward. I think having the group that's been set up is a good thing.
Just touching on the mitigation measures then that you've introduced, what else are they? Because, you know, they've obviously looked at the experiences in Tayside, and that's, you know, why they're so unhappy or concerned about what might happen in the future.
Yeah, well, it's quite different in the national park, I suppose. We've gone quite a bit above and beyond the national mitigation scheme. We've carried out flood bank surveys. We've mapped areas where there's potential for, if beavers are in those areas, to have high impacts on agricultural land. We've got a beaver officer in place. We're looking to take forward the applications for mitigation on behalf of farmers. So we've tried to put in place to make sure that it's as simple as possible, to make sure that we get the benefits from beavers in the area, but also that we deal with any negative impacts as quickly as possible, and try and make sure that we learn to live alongside beavers within the national park.
Well, it's something like species reintroduction, Grant. Where does that idea come from? Who dreams it up, and who actually pushes it forward?
Well, I suppose in terms of this, I mean, this is goes well back to the year, you know, into the early 2000s, where there was the beaver reintroduction trial across in Argyll. And then obviously changes in government policy over the next decade as well. And then eventually Scottish Government changed policy to allow for beaver translocations into other other catchments. And we took a paper to the Cairngorms National Park Authority Board to say that the Park Authority should lead on that in terms of the Spey catchment. That was agreed to, and we've taken forward that work. So I suppose it's been a 20-year process in terms of from the start when people were thinking about reintroductions for beaver, and I suppose for other species it's been similar. And, you know, we've been doing obviously there's work in the park on wildcat recently in terms of that sort of things, but also things like pine hoverfly as well, and other smaller species that I suppose get less limelight on them. So there's lots of different ways, but it's, you know, there's a beaver species translocation code as well that things have to follow. So there's lots of work around that, and there's a national forum as well that looks at all these issues.
I suppose what I was trying to get out there, Grant, I mean, I accept the fact there's a long history of this, but you know, you put forward a paper to the Cairngorms National Park Board saying we think this is a good idea and we should lead on this. Is there any way, I mean, other than the fact the board might say no, we don't think this is a good idea, is there any way once that's happened of this being stopped? You know, if Joe Public's not happy with it, could it have been stopped at any stage?
Well, we put in the licence application to Nature Scott. Nature Scott considered all the evidence, including our engagement report, where we set out quite clearly that not everyone on the agricultural side wanted to see beavers come back, and then Nature Scott make that decision on the licence for the translocation. So that was one side. And I suppose the other thing to look at is that when the board made the decision, it is made up of people who are elected locally and also local councillors and then some national appointees as well. So the board's representative as well of the National Park and makes decisions within the National Park Authority.
Yeah, it's interesting, very interesting. But the bottom line here is you think that the formation of this new group is a good thing for communication.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we can have a group of farmers that come together that want to work on key issues across the national park, there's some big things happening in agriculture over the next few years with changes to agricultural payments, the new agricultural bill. There's lots of work that we're looking to take forward with farmers, and we are doing that with lots of farmers across the park in terms of working on mob grazing. We're doing work on drystone dikes. We're doing work on lots of different things. We want to work with people to try and make the park a better place. And if there's a group that we can work with, that we can listen to, that they can hear where the park authority is coming from as well, and we have that two-way dialogue, then that can only be a good thing.
Grant, thanks very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks very much.
Grant Moy, the Chief Executive of the Cairngorms National Park Authority.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point that he makes as well, that engagement doesn't always mean agreement.
No, absolutely. Moving on, more than £1 million is being spent upgrading one of the most popular trails in the North East. The money from Sustrans and Nestrans will improve accessibility, replace and repair bridges, and in places widen the route on the Fermartin and Buchan Way.
Last week I caught up with Councillor Isabel Davidson, Ross Morrison from Sustrans, and Malcolm White from Aberdeenshire Council. We started our walk in Ellen, it was still pretty snowy at that time, and immediately encountered a set of bollards, which Ross explains will soon be a thing of the past.
These are access controls. Historically, they've been installed to essentially mitigate antisocial behaviour. The ones we're looking at where we're standing are bollard arrangements in the chicane. Now, the issue we've got here is that although they are mitigating antisocial behaviour, they're also forming a barrier for people who have accessibility issues. So we are going to come in, we're going to remove these bollards, we're going to install similar arrangements, but they will be installed in dimensionally that allows a free flow of traffic. So our primary goal is paths for everyone. That means we need to open the paths up for everyone, and these barriers are definitely a barrier to most people.
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine taking the buggy up through that. It would be a bit of a struggle. But yeah, definitely today, because there's still quite a bit of snow on the ground. So the new arrangement will make that a lot easier, but it will still keep vehicles out.
Yeah, it will keep vehicles out, but the bollards will be demountable as well. That means they could be removed if you have the correct key. And that's so that we can get maintenance vehicles onto the path as well. The arrangement we've got here is one of the better ones I've seen. There are terrible ones where you've physically got barriers, where you've got step overs, you've got gates. There's all a whole bunch of things that really do affect people's ability to access the network.
Let's take a little wander up here then, because it is a beautiful winter's day. As I say, quite a bit of snow still on the ground, but the sun's out as well. Isabel, this is such a popular route, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's very popular. People now are so interested in getting outdoors and walking, and this is great, and it links up parts of the town as well. You can cross the river, you know, and there's a really good connected footpaths around here. And you can see just by the footprints in the snow just how popular it is. So it's great to have this facility, and people can choose the length of walks that they want to go on, you know, and they can go from town to town and they can commute along it. So it's a great thing to have, absolutely.
And of course it makes good use of the old railway line.
Absolutely, it was so inspired to... for the council at that time to make sure that they took over the whole railway line to keep that open path throughout Aberdeenshire. You know, that was such a good decision. And I think it cost £1 at the time.
So tell me about the kind of work that's going to take place here then.
So there's been the access control improvements, which we've talked about. There's improving the drainage on the route as well. This is, a frequent problem for many sections. It's because drains have become blocked, there can be flooding, and again, that makes the route more inaccessible. So improving the drainage, also widening the route, this is usually as a result of overgrowth over time, and if it becomes narrower, then it makes it harder for a range of different users to use it at once. We are having replacement of 5 active travel bridges along the route, and then also there's the refurbishment of the Eithin Viaduct. Some instances we're also looking to improve the surface as well, again, to make it more accessible for a wider range of users.
We're just pausing for a second here, and we're scraping the snow off the track so that we can see the surface.
Yeah, so where we're standing at the moment is what we call a sealed surface. Now, the sealed surface is porous, or it doesn't allow water to seep through it, which means that we can design it in such a way that it sheds the water to either side of the path. That's one of the big problems we've got with unsealed paths, is that they don't have the longevity like a sealed path does. And 95% of the section we're looking at is unsealed surface at the moment. And it's affected by weather, rain, poor drainage. And the culmination of all that ultimately destroys the path, the unbound paths. The thing we've got to be careful about with these are that they are quite urban by their nature. Now, we're in a very rural section of the path, coming from Newmarket up to Auchnagat and beyond. And a lot of residents and locals they're quite sensitive about the approach we have to putting sealed surfaces in within rural areas. So we've got to be very careful and engage and consult about how we progress any proposals for sealed surfaces. But the big advantage for a sealed surface is accessibility. That allows everybody onto the network, no matter your ability, your age or anything. But as we've discussed previously, on the unbound surfaces, they tend to erode very quickly, and that creates problems for people underfoot, people wheeling, people cycling. So we would like to roll out more sealed surfacing, but that's something that the community needs to consider, and if it is something that they want to do. We are looking at rolling them out at key areas at the moment, so that's the main settlements. Newmarket, we're looking at 690 metres of sealed surfacing north of Newmarket.
Why is it sensitive?
As I said, it is an urban type of finish. So visually and aesthetically, it feels quite urban when you walk on it. There's also, for people, equestrian use. They generally prefer an unbound surface for the horses. So we've got to consider that as well.
And is it expensive to achieve and maintain, I wonder?
Well, it's expensive to achieve, but it's far less maintenance of burden for the local authorities to take on. We know that the lifespan of a sealed surface is a lot longer than an unbound surface. So yeah, there's definitely a cost up front, but there's a big payoff in terms of the life cycle of the sealed surface over the longer term.
Ross Morrison there, Malcolm White and Isabel Davidson.
Yeah, now, someone who has horses, mm-hmm. what would you prefer to be on?
Unbound.
Yeah, I thought unbound, you might say that.
Tarmac can get very, very slippy. You know, and despite the fact they've got four horses, they can be quite extraordinarily clumsy sometimes.
Uh-huh.
You know, and just for no good reason, fall over sideways.
Mm-hmm.
And it can cause a lot of damage,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. You can see, though, for some people, a tarred surface, for
Without
example, would be a lot easier. And Ross gave a good example of that. He said his own mum, who was a bit older, would go out on a path quite near her house just because it was a lovely, even surface. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she would meet up with other people. So I can see that it definitely does improve accessibility. Very expensive, of course, to achieve as well.
It is. No, I quite take the point about accessibility, because a friend of mine, Andrew, who used to do pieces for this programme, and he is paraplegic, and he turned up one time to do a piece about a new, basically all abilities sculpture trail. I can't remember where it was. I mean, it was a long time ago. But he phoned me up in hysterics of laughter, and I said, what's the problem? He says, gravel. He says, what? He says, they've put down gravel. I said, you're joking. He says, no. He says, I can't get anywhere near it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is a big issue.
Soft surface won't work.
Yeah. You know? It shows as well, I think, how the thinking has changed, not just in terms of surfaces, but everything else. Because in the 90s, when they were looking at this route, you know, the priority was putting gates in and barriers in to stop cars and motorbikes from whizzing down the railway line. They just don't really get that now. And it is about trying to allow all people onto the route.
Yeah. No, it's a good route. But, I mean, I did it by bike just as we came out of COVID, you know, in a sense, or one of the times we came out of COVID. And I still have a thermos flask with a dirty, great big dent in the side of it because I hit a patch of ice. I mean, it was conditions like you had the other day, but colder, you know, and I hit this patch of ice, went over sideways on the bike and what have you, and landed on the thermos flask.
Oops.
Didn't do the thermos flask any good at all.
Well, I bet it didn't.
Didn't do me any good at all. You're listening to The Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens, sitting here right next to the fire at Beechgrove as Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, as we say every week, there's umpteen ways of listening again.
Yeah, you know what's coming here. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the quite excellent Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Every week we ask you to tell us where you listen to this podcast. We got this in from Amanda Hughes Horan in Texas. She says, I'm a Brit living in Texas. So interested to hear both sides of the river management issue. Here in Houston, as you know, we had severe flooding a number of years ago with Hurricane Harvey, and the city's been working on a riparian restoration program with tree planting schemes to help slow floodwaters, increase absorption rates, and provide for wildlife habitat. Homeowners, and this is interesting, are also being bought out along our bayous to provide a green corridor and allow our rivers to breathe as they wind their way across the coastal plain towards the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, she continues, I completely understand that farmers must grow food. We depend on them, of course. But if areas further upstream in the Scottish Highlands are farmed too intensively or overgrazed, then there is nothing to hold the water back. It's a tough situation, but Mother Nature always wins. And we need to work with her and respect these natural systems. Thanks so much for the wonderful show. I've listened to it for years, and that's from Amanda Hughes Horan in Houston.
Worth pointing out, though, that we haven't really been talking about the fact that farms are being farmed too intensively or indeed overgrazed in the Scottish Highlands. You know, the concern amongst farmers is right now there is farmland being inundated by growing floodwaters, and it's what you actually do about that.
Mm, indeed.
Anyway, time for our mystery sound again. Have a listen. Now, these are incorrect but quite credible answers. Betty reckons it's bacon fat spilling onto the fire. That's more of a whoosh. We've done that several times before, to be honest, Betty. Into the fire, dropping it onto the tarmac.
Yes, we've had that a few times too. Yeah.
Karen in Shetland reckons it's only 3 days till Uphelia, Candlemas, Imbolc, the Old Norse Distincting, turning time, the return of the sun, so morning should be getting light on it. They are, Karen. But she adds, and this caught our attention, is the noise boiling sugar with cream cream of tartar added, making puff candy. I had no idea you made puff candy that way.
We know what you'll be up to tonight then. Alistair back in Elgin says, good morning, Rachel and Mark. Despite your clue, I will guess today's mystery sound is what a sleepy listener gets when they accidentally detune their radio and lose the best programme on radio and get only get static. In other words, I don't have a clue. Excellent walking in Strathpeffer last week. 4 days and only caught in the rain once. A miracle.
Excellent.
Keep up the good work.
Excellent. Barry McGowan thinks it may be a sparkler. Alan Burnhouse thought it might be a Wimhurst machine. I'm not sure what that is.
No.
Is that like a sort of Van de Graaff generator?
I don't even know what that is.
You know what I mean? Is it the sound of a wildcat's tail near an electric fence? Steady, Al.
Oh.
Stu and Dias thinks higher management, also known as my good lady, thinks it's a gorse bush on fire. That's remarkably close.
Ah, Bill from West Hill. Is it the mystery? Is it the sound of a shower of hailstones?
Mm-hmm. Jim Greensmith in Helensburgh thought it might be an electric fence on a farm. Love the programme content and listen every week.
Alistair and Nikki from Leven, enjoying learning new things this morning without any effort. We still use a wooden fruit bowl one of our sons made 30 years ago.
Well, you've
at school.
Got to, haven't you? It's kind of obligatory.
Well, he must be more talented than me. We think the mystery sound is grain turning in a grain drying machine. Good guesses.
All good suggestions. But yeah. There's a new podcast just come out from BBC Scotland, which we think you might be interested in.
Yeah, it's called House of the Lion, and it's presented by Susan Morrison and Len Penny.
Now, the focus is medieval Scotland, and it's very, very, very brutal history.
It's 1214. Alexander II is the King of Scots, and he is not someone you cross. He's no stranger to killing already, but his royal cloak is on a sugarly peg. He's got plenty of rivals who've been breathing down his family's neck for years, and he's going to prove to everyone that there's no limit to his savagery and the things he's going to do to keep the throne.
Yeah, this is sometimes a gory tale, so please be warned. We'll be dealing with death and violence in sometimes very graphic detail, and we'll need to use a wee bit of bad language.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Richard Oram of Stirling University describes Alexander II.
Alexander II, he's a bit of a hero of mine.
You've gone so fanboy.
Alexander II is possibly one of the most singularly unpleasant people ever to occupy the Scottish throne.
That wasn't the line I was expecting to hear.
No, I mean, you can admire somebody hugely, okay. But you know, his methods are just absolutely brutal.
Wow, this guy's just something else.
Oh yeah, he does get things done, but I'm guessing he's not big on empathy.
Getting to grips with exactly what Alexander is capable of, Dr. Susan Marshall in Aberdeen.
He understands the power of a brutal act publicly performed that underscores your sovereignty and your ruthlessness. He has a bishop in Caithness called Adam, but he is murdered by farmers in Caithness who trap him in his property and set fire to it. So Alexander II retaliates by having dozens of the people involved rounded up, and they have their hands and feet cut off.
Right, that's a fairly dramatic statement to make.
Yep. Following a rebellion in Galloway, he gets two of the ringleaders and he has them publicly torn apart by horses.
But hang on, do you think he sat about and dreamt up different ways of dealing with people?
I mean,
just beheading is just too straightforward, guys. I'm looking for something really fancy here.
Yeah, I want drama.
Drama? I want theatre. I want people to be talking about this for a long time, which of course they do.
They did.
Yes. I'm going to hand it to the boy. Sense of theatre.
An extract from Susan Morrison and Len Penny's new podcast, House of the Lion, which is available now on BBC Sounds.
Yeah. Mary from St Andrews has been in touch. You were talking about the moon earlier and how spectacular it was yesterday. The wolf moon is the name given to the first full moon of the year, which usually occurs in January. The wolf moon 2024 happened on Burns Night, so January the 25th at about 5 to 6. This is when the moon was fully illuminated by the sun as the earth is positioned directly between them. The name Wolf Moon is thought to be derived from the howling of wolves at this time of year when food is scarce. Nice bit of info there.
No, absolutely. And beautifully counterpointed by the sound of the radio in the car that's delivering the newspapers.
I notice he's not listening to us.
No.
Terrible.
I'll be speaking to him harshly next week. We return now to the Highland Wildlife Park at Kinyusi to catch up on the latest news of the 19 wildcat kittens released into... Well, they weren't kittens by the time they were released. Released into the Cairngorms National Park last summer. Helen Sen is head of conservation and science there, and she gave me the lowdown on how they've been able to keep track of the cats.
They all have GPS collars on them. Our expert field team would spend all day tracking them. On regular intervals, we download the data from those collars and we can see really where the cat's been and exactly what it's doing at any point in time. So we've got really good information on them, and that's super valuable because we're trying to learn as much as we can about this elusive species. So that's how we know what they're doing, and that's how we know that 18 of them are alive. One cat, sadly, has died shortly after release, and it died of a health condition. So every animal that does die, we will go and find, and we'll do a post-mortem, and our vet will try and establish, obviously, what the cause of death is. But yeah, so far we've had a great success, but there's lots of threats out there for wildcats. You know, that's why they went extinct in the first place. In general, life is tough for carnivores, and the kinds of threats we're worrying about, you know, things like road traffic mortality, also potentially ongoing persecution. That was a factor that led to their demise in the first place. Obviously, if it was you or I out in the wild at this time of year, we'd be struggling perhaps a little bit more than usual to find things to eat, and certainly that's going to be the case even for an expert predator like the wildcat.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've spent decades wandering about Scotland. I think I saw a wildcat once, and it was just disappearing, basically, you know, around the back of a bush. I couldn't swear to it, but I think it was a wildcat. They are remarkably shy.
Yes, and how many years ago would you say that was? Do you remember?
I would have been in my 20s, so you're talking over 30 years ago.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. We often have people come and tell us similar stories, but normally it was, you know, more than 30 years ago that they had that experience. And there's certainly been, we know there's been a real decline recently. They are generally quite elusive animals, but I think it's also important to note that there's a lot of variation in animal behaviour, and we're certainly seeing that with our cats that we have in the breeding centre and that we've released out into the wild. And there are people, there are sightings, there are some that are less shy, and in the winter some of them are coming down and associating more with human habitations, and I think that's probably completely normal. We don't know, you know, to what extent the life that they've had so far is influencing their behaviour, and we won't really know that until we've got quite a lot more data. But certainly I think a really key message with animal behaviour is that, you know, animals have personalities too. There are some that are more shy, some that are more bold, and that's kind of part of the, I suppose, the tapestry of life really, and we can't really prejudge what's good or bad at this point in time.
Domestic cats have been around Scotland for a long, long time. Is there such a thing as a 100% Scottish wildcat out there at the moment?
I don't think there's any 100% wildcats out there anymore, but there certainly used to be. And the thing that's really fascinating is that domestic cat have been in Britain since the Romans, ostensibly, but they seem to have lived alongside wildcat for really hundreds and thousands of years without there being much evidence of interbreeding at all. And we know that now from, you know, genomic analysis that we've done, and also looking at the archaeological record. And that's some of the research that's come out of this team. And so we know that hybridization really only started being a problem about 60 or so years ago.
Why do you think that was? Was it the number of, presumably, the sort of... the overall number of wildcats had dropped to such an extent that they were left with no recourse but to breed with domestic animals?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, kind of what would you call it? Small town syndrome or desert island syndrome?
Didn't have a bike.
Yeah. So I think it's hybridisation is a symptom, not a cause of population decline. So when populations become really small and fragmented for other reasons.
So, and the cats that you released, you say released 19, 18 of them are still alive. They're still moving out there. You've got satellite collars on them. Have they travelled far or have they stayed in this area?
Most of the cats have stayed in and around the release site, but people who've been following the project might be aware that there's one cat that did a really big journey. So we're here in the northern Cairngorms, and it hiked all the way across the top of Ben, pretty much the top of Ben Macdooey, which is second highest mountain in Scotland, the highest mountain in the Cairngorms, and it headed down towards Deeside and towards the Marlodge area. And that's a really fascinating journey. You know, we know that cats do big journeys and we know that they cross high land, but it's really the first time we've been able to evidence that happening as well. So a really fascinating story, and obviously, again, you know, lots to learn from that experience.
Yeah. And are you able to, I mean, you can obviously see them on a computer screen, little dots moving about at certain, you know, a line that you can follow showing their travels. Are you able to see them at all? Because, I mean, I would imagine you're catching the electronic signal. The chances of actually catching a visual of anything is pretty low.
Yeah, so we, as I said, we don't really see them very often, but certainly the field team that are out and about tracking the cats do see them. And also we've got lots of people that are being our eyes and ears on the ground. So we've been really grateful to have help from the National Trust for Scotland team at Mar Lodge, helping tracking the cat that went over that way. But also a lot of other keepers, gamekeepers and rangers and people who are in contact with the project and have provided us sightings, and people from the general public as well. And that's really useful information.
What is it about it as an animal that fascinates you so much?
I think they're just, you know, they're kind of feisty and they're here really against the odds. And I think that's what I'm really passionate about, is trying to do everything we can to reverse the decline of this species. I would like to see a Scotland where we have healthy populations of wild cats in the future, not just ones that are, you know, clinging on by a claw. I just really hope that we can do the best for this animal.
Helen Senner of the Highland Wildlife Park at Kinusey.
Yeah, and you think you saw one?
A long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. A long time ago. I mean, I'm trying to think, probably in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I think it was actually in the West Highland Way, and I just came around the corner of a track. I was just by myself. And I saw something disappearing behind a tree. Mm-hmm. And they are remarkably, remarkably shy animals.
Yeah. But you didn't get a close enough look at the markings or anything like that? It was just a flash?
No, but where it was sufficiently remote. It was unlikely to be a feral cat. It's possible, I suppose, feral. But, I mean, that's one of the real difficulties of it.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, there's been times I've walked into folks' houses. There's been something asleep in front of the fire, and I thought, really? Is that actually a domestic cat? Or is that a wildlife cat that's opted for the easy life?
Yeah. You can see why that would have an appeal, don't you? It will be interesting to see as they roll this out whether people start to, you know, notice them in the countryside. Mm. I think it might take a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know, people are concerned about... It's interesting, because people are concerned about things like sort of chickens and ducks and geese and things like that. Oh, you know, what if... Otters take as many of those things as anything else, and you never hear anybody complaining about otters.
No, that's true. Maybe it is a profile thing, is it?
They've got a PR problem, that's the thing.
Recently, you'll remember a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about what we think could have been the discovery of a 1,000-year-old skull close to the sea caves at East Weems. Coastal erosion unearthed this rather interesting discovery, but it's also an issue causing, as you can understand, huge concern to those working hard to protect this hugely significant Pictish carvings in the caves themselves. Mike Arrowsmith is from Save Weems Ancient Cave Society.
It's a real major threat, and you can see where we're standing now, the rock armour along the coastline. If they hadn't have dumped the coal waste here in the 19th and early 20th centuries, there'd be even more erosion than there is now. So in a way, that's been protecting the caves themselves. But yes, it's a huge problem, and it's not just the erosion from the direct action of the sea. If you go inside the caves, you'll see at the moment they're very wet, and that's water penetration coming through because of the increased rainfall. So climate change is a real issue for us here, and projections are that in 100 years time, if sea level rise continues in the same way it is, you won't be able to get into those caves anymore. They'll actually be underwater again. So we do what we can now to protect what's there, but also study it. We've taken laser scans of the entire interior and exterior of the site, so if the worst came to the worst and they weren't still around in 100 years time, we've got all that data and all that those digital models to work with. So we're preserving it in that sense for the future.
We're standing outside one of the caves just now, and obviously we can't come here without going inside. Just before we do, tell me a little bit about this one.
Okay, so we're about to go into Cork Cave, which the name sort of betrays what it was used for. So it's associated with the medieval Macduff Castle on the cliffs above. There's two aspects to this cave. There's the passageway down the side. It has a carving called Thor and his goat, is how he's known locally. And then in the main chamber, we've got a panel of Pictish carvings. If people have seen the large Pictish stones in the landscape or the particularly good collection in the National Museum in Scotland, these are big monumental stones with very sophisticated, high-quality carving. We don't have that here. Our symbols are much simpler. They're much cruder to look at, although you need to bear in mind that they've been there exposed to the elements getting on for 2,000 years, and so they're not going to look that good. Plus the human activity. So as well as being the court, we know that later on this was a miner's restroom. So they would gather in here and basically gamble. And we've got photographs of them doing that from the 1930s. And it's remarkable that they've survived actually. And it shows the respect that people have had for them. They may not have understood what they are, but surprisingly, little damage has happened over the years. Most of the damage, vandalism, etc., is actually in the last 30 years. So for most of the time they've been there, they've been respected and looked after.
Now, you've got the magic key because the gates are locked during the winter months, aren't they?
Yes, and that's partly for people's own protection. As you see when we go in, it's very muddy underfoot in places. It's very slippery. And we want to ensure that no rock's going to fall on anybody's heads. But we do have keys deposited with local shops, so if people want to come down and access them out of the summer months, they can do. And the crucial thing is that we keep them locked overnight, because that's when the parties happen. At the same time as wanting to protect them, we don't want to block them off to people, because we're very clear that this heritage belongs not to us or to anybody else, but it belongs to local people. So if you look at this wall here, this was completely dry a few months ago, and you can just see the water is now pouring through down the side of the cave. That's going to be having an effect. You can see it's coming down the fault in the rock here. And, you know, one of the things that we have to do is regularly inspect the caves. There has been, as you can see outside, there has been collapse here because the coal mining, the shafts go underneath here and out into the Forth. That's had a lot of destabilising effect. These pillars were put in by the coal company in the 1930s to try and stabilise the roof. The one outside failed because it's under tons of rock now. But these are still standing. And so one of the things we do is monitor this and check that there's no ongoing damage by measuring the gaps between the faults in the rock and so on.
Yeah, I mean, the rock is soaking wet. Is there anything that you can do to try to stop this?
Short of putting a roof on the whole site, no.
Yeah.
No, it's a cave. It's a natural formation. The best we can do is to try is possibly protect the coastline, but that's an expensive job. The village itself has got a protective wall in front of it. And at the time, when that was built, it was decided not to extend it along the coastline in front of the caves. Perhaps in hindsight, it should have been, but it wasn't. Given current economic climate and priorities, competing priorities, I think it would be a big ask to spend what would be many millions of pounds to protect it. But then I think it's a very, very important site. And if we're serious about our history and we're serious about understanding where Scotland came from and some of the origins and some of the ideas behind it, it's a really important site to protect. So we would love to do things, but unless there's anybody out there listening that's got access to a huge amount of money, there's practically very little we can do.
Mike Arsworth there from the Save Weems Ancient Cave Society.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? What do you do? There's not very much they can do, and I suppose that's why the modelling and the laser scans and all that kind of stuff that they do is so important. So at least there's some kind of trace of it in the future if they are to lose access to it.
It's interesting what you're saying about the mine spoil. So actually, protecting the caves.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are other very, very good examples of that, obviously up in Orkney, but not mine spoil, but just sand drift and things like that. And I saw a photograph quite recently, and it was taken about 1880, something like that, and it was of the Sphinx. And the Sphinx at that stage was been about, I would say, half buried in sand.
Yeah.
It was only much later that it was actually cleared out. I mean, you could basically, it's just head and shoulders
Yeah.
is all you could see.
burial's not a bad thing.
No, no, and it is interesting that the mining heritage there has probably done some good, but at the same time he was saying that that also prevented these caves from having the kind of recognition and protection that they've deserved, yeah. Because the Great and Gooden Society didn't really want to come to East Weems because it was a mining place.
Aye, yeah. No, very strange. Anyway, it was, of course, Burns Night this past week, and, you know, I'm doing a Burns Supper tonight. White Lashes Village Hall, that's not an advert because every ticket's been sold for months and months and months.
Is that just because you're the star attraction?
No, it's not. It's just, it's a great wee burn supper. But I mean, you know, there are burn suppers all over the world. You know, we're not talking hundreds of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of burn suppers, you know, everywhere.
We were actually talking about what makes a good trifle, but we'll leave that for now.
this is the important stuff. Yeah.
Although we associate Robert Burns with Alloway in the southwest of Scotland, his roots actually go back to the northeast where we are now.
Now, we'll hear more about that shortly from Professor Alison Lumsden of Aberdeen University. But first, let's just remind ourselves of just how good Burns was in terms of his observational ability in the natural world. This is To a Mouse, read by Brian Cox.
Wee sleeked, cowering, timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start awa sae hasty wi' bickering brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee wi' murdering pattle.
Burns was a fantastic observer of wildlife, really knowledgeable.
I think that's true, and I think that's because he's actually working on the land, and he has that very close and intimate relationship with the land, and he's outside working and seeing nature, engaging with nature, feeling it in arts elements, so he'd have been in a day like this, which is terrible, and he would have been intimately connected with that, and that really comes across in his work.
I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
So when you see something like To a Mouse or To a Daisy, it's that kind of very intimate, close-up look at nature that he gets from actually having worked on the land, I think.
Wee modest crimson tippet floor, thou's met me in an evil hour, for I maun crush among the stour thy slender stem. To spare thee now is past my poor, thou bonny gem.
Tell me about the connections between Robert Burns and the northeast of Scotland. How far back did it go?
Well, a lot of folk didn't realise this, but Burns's father was from near Stonehaven at Dunnottar, where he farmed and trained as a gardener. So he was there before he went to Ayrshire and moved his family down to Ayrshire. So there's a strong sense that they had northeast connections. When Burns did his grand tour of Scotland in the pomp of his fame, he came to visit some of his relations round about Dunnottar and Stonehaven. So he was very aware of that connection. And so are the people of the northeast, because there are several statues to commemorate Burns and his connection to the northeast here in Aberdeen and near Stonehaven.
There's a cracking statue of Burns just overlooking Union Terrace Gardens, and there's also an odd wee monument in a lay-by on the A90 just south of Stonehaven.
Aye. I think there's a high chance that's been moved at some point, but that's commemorating Burns' father and the connections of Burns to the northeast and his father's connections to the northeast.
Cold blew the bitter biting north upon thy early humble birth, yet cheerfully thou glinted forth amid the storm, scarce reared above the parent earth thy tender form.
Do you see evidence in his work? Do you see evidence in his language that suggests that he was influenced by the northeast?
That's a very difficult question in some way, because the honest truth is we've no idea how Burns would actually have spoken. All we've got are the words on the page. And sometimes with poets and writers, you can gauge from maybe how they rhyme things, how they might have spoken. But I don't think there's that much evidence in Burns. He's using general Scots. He's using Scots that had been familiar by the time he was writing from other writers involved in the Scots vernacular revival. And, of course, there's a sense in which he's also adopting work from all over Scotland that had existed. So I think it's quite hard to find that evidence. But what you do find is a very rich Scots vocabulary in his work. So there's a high chance he is drawing from particular words or pronunciations of words that might have come from the northeast.
There, in thy scanty mantle clad, Thy snowy bosom sunward spread, thou lifts thy unassuming head in humble guise. But now the sheer up tears thy bed, and low thou lies.
Because I've been raised in the northeast, because I'd grown up with people that spoke Doric, it made perfect sense to me. The music of it made perfect sense to me.
I think that's true. And I mean, I know, for example, I can't say barns as a one-syllable word, so I've always got to explain. And they are called Baroness, and they dropped the E when they went south. And so I think there's that sense in which that intonation is definitely there. But that kind of musicality, I think you can find throughout Scots. And also, there's a sense in which Scotland is so steeped in tradition and stories, and stories that have come from the ordinary people. These stories were passed around Scotland in probably a far more mobile way than we might imagine. I think with the sense that folk were stuck in their ain wee bit and that they didn't get to move about very much. But there was far more movement around Scotland and between Scotland and England, for that matter, at the time. And so I think stories would have passed on and they would have travelled around. And Walter Scott, who collected a lot of traditional stories, he uses this lovely phrase, communities of fable. You know, the idea that these stories are kind of all over the place, not just in Scotland and even in Britain, but beyond, across the world, you find the same stories, the same folk beliefs popping up all over the place. And I think Barnes is drawing on that very rich tradition, which is Scottish in one sense, but it's also more than Scottish, which is probably part of his international appeal as well.
Thou wee bit hoosie too in ruin, it silly was, the winds are strewn, and naethin now to big and newin, o foggage green, and bleak December's winds ensuin, baith snell and keen.
I think there's a sense, particularly when it comes to language, that when we speak Doric or North East Scots, we're speaking something different from what they might speak in other parts of Scotland. Whereas, in fact, what you find in Burns and in a lot of the writers in the 18th and 19th centuries, that commonality of language. It's just that we've lost a lot of the words because we're nae farmers anymore, so we didn't use the words that they would have used. So you've kind of lost that connections, which actually I think there's probably more in common with language across Scotland than people sometimes realise.
Thou saw the fields lay bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here, beneath the blast, thou thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed out through thy cell.
You know, the words on the page don't have an accent, so it's only when you read them aloud that they have an accent. And obviously what is printed there will influence how you read it out. But when I read, you know, Pleasures Are Like Poppies Spread from Tam O'Shanter, which is entirely in English, and Burns was perfectly capable in writing in English, then I'm going to read it in a northeast accent. So then you ask, well, what language am I reading it in? Am I reading it in Scots or in English? Because the person who reads it aloud will put their own stamp on it, and they'll bring it alive from the page into something that is read aloud in their own particular way.
But Mousie, thou art no thy lane, and proven foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes o' mice and men gang after glory, and layest not but grief and pain for promised joy. Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee, but och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear.
Brian Cox, reading To a Mouse by Robert Burns, and my thanks to Professor Alison Lumsden of Aberdeen University there. And as you could hear, we met on a very, very windy day.
It's actually got a bit windy now, although the most gorgeous sky. If you are interested in hearing some more Burns-related content, then do look up the BBC website, and there's lots of recordings on there, including something new that's just been made at this year's Celtic Connections, featuring the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, with various musicians celebrating Burns, including own Gary Innes and BBC Radio Scotland Young Traditional Musician of the Year Amy Lawrenson. So just look for Burns Night 2024 on the iPlayer.
Yeah. Nice. Time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a quick listen. I have to say, we got this nearly immediately.
Well, you got it nearly immediately.
Yeah, because while Gordon and Maureen from Nettybridge got it absolutely spot on, is the mystery sound the burning of a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
Tommy got it too.
Yeah, Grace Curry and Kirkwall. Also, the shrub that Mark asked about, I think it's a viburnum.
I think that's the correct answer. Ross and Tainalt got the correct answer. So Diane and Ian Cozy in the Trossachs say, is the mystery sound the sound of Mark burning his old Christmas tree? I think the burning pine needles make this sound. They do make that sound, but I don't actually burn the whole tree. I cut the branches off and I keep the stem on Ewan's advice and I cut it up, and that's what lights my Christmas fire the following year.
Yeah, that's a nice.
So the Christmas
tradition.
Tree gets a second life,
yeah,
essentially.
I like that. Very good. Yeah. Gordon in Glasgow also got in touch with us to tell you the name of your scented pink flowers as well.
Our midweek podcast this week on Wednesday, Helen will be speaking to cellist Jessica Kerr about her project Stories of Peoples and Trees. That's coming out on Wednesday. From all of the team here in BBC Aberdeen, as ever, thank you very much for listening.